April 16th is National Healthcare Decisions Day, a day to have a conversation and designate someone to speak for you when you can no longer speak for yourself during a serious illness or at the end of life. Hi, welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Myra Christopher is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics, and Marshall Scott is the chaplain and manager for spiritual wellness at St. Luke's South Hospital in Overland Park, Kansas. Myra, tell us why this day, April the 16th, National Healthcare Decisions Day, is so important.
It is intended to be a social prompt to give people a reason to have conversations that are so often delayed or postponed. And yes, the connection is with death and taxes. When the group was working to decide which day this would be, there were a number of days considered, Thanksgiving, Memorial Day, and so forth. And I think maybe with a little bit of macabre humor, it was decided that it would be April 16th. But this is the third year of National Health Decisions Day.
And Marshall, that to you in your work at St. Luke's South, it's important for people to be able to designate someone to speak for themselves when they're seriously ill or at the end of life.
It's a critical opportunity for patients to have the comfort that their wishes and their values will be represented, and an opportunity for us as caregivers and for the families who are frequently having to make decisions for these patients to say, we know what the patient wants. It's not our values that we're imposing. It's not our anxiety that we have to reflect. We know what the patient wants, and we can follow those wishes.
You know, it's not unusual that people will ask me, well, how would you know what the right decision is? Well, when you're talking about people who don't have capacity, and that's the focus of advanced care planning, then the only way, in my opinion, that you can know you've come to a place where you all have the peace of mind that you're making, quote unquote, the right decision, is if you can honestly say, to the best of our ability and our knowledge, we believe that this is congruent with what the patient's goals and values are, and we honor this person in making that decision. And of course, if you have something that documents that, then it's just an added benefit. It's just added relief to those who ultimately are responsible for making very difficult decisions.
Marshall, I imagine you as a chaplain, you've worked with the best side of this and the worst side of this.
Yes. In fact, I have really two venues in which I talk about this. One is as a chaplain. The other is as an Episcopal priest filling in for colleagues on Sunday morning. And I often take the opportunity to say to the congregation, look, we know that we're going to die. The mortality rate is 100%. We know that everyone is going to die. As your clergy, we are called to remind you of that, help you make preparation, and part of that preparation is the possibility that before you die, you're going to be too sick to make decisions for yourself. And with that in mind, there's some things I want you to do. And so this is a reminder. What I frequently tell them is that the worst place to have to confront this with that information is at 2 o'clock in the morning at the bedside in intensive care.
Absolutely. And you know, we also know, Marshall, that the vast majority of Americans say this is something that they value, the right to make advance directives, and that they want to do it. But the gap between the 75 to 80% of people who will make that statement and the 30% of people who actually do have the conversation and do make advance directives is particularly serious when you marry that with data that 85% of us will not have the capacity to make decisions for ourselves at the end of life. Someone else will bear that burden, that duty, that obligation, however you think about that. Our battle cry here is, have you had the talk? Because we really do feel strongly that the focus ought not to be on documents, that legal transactional models are not very effective. The focus needs to be on communication.
Marshall, the center is offering a new and improved tool for this talk, a revised version of Caring Conversations.
For years, I've been telling people that the three steps that they needed to take were to have the conversation, pointing out that that's the hardest part, and then perhaps to get it down on paper, and then to spread that paper around. And the revision of the Caring Conversations workbook takes very much the same approach. It's step into step-by-step, a five-step tool. Step one being taking the time to reflect, to think about what your values are, to think about how you want to live and how you want people to care for you at the end of life. Then to have the conversation is step two, to have the talk about that. And then consider how you need to distribute that information, certainly putting it down on paper, but going beyond that to who needs that pieces, who needs that paper, who needs to have access to it. And then having opportunities to review it again periodically, to know that, you know, your life changes, that things change for you in your family, both to review it periodically yourself and, again, to keep the conversation fresh with family members, taking a step-by-step approach. And, again, focusing on a conversational, a relational point of view. One of the things I emphasize when I orient new clinical employees at St. Luke's South to these issues, and that's a part of my responsibility itself, is to say it is always worth it to take extra time and trouble to build a team, to have the family and the caregivers on the same page with the same information. And it's the same principle in the Caring Conversations tool. You have the patient, you have the individual, and all of the family members in the same conversation so that they all have the same information, the same sense of team when this information needs to be used.
Myra, we've been talking primarily about patients and families having this kind of conversation, but it's just as important, or perhaps even more important, for medical professionals to have this talk for themselves and their families.
Physicians are key in this. Patients expect their physicians to have these conversations with them and also believe that their physician is a better quality provider when they do have those conversations. One of the things that we have learned about some institutions doing that I find very hopeful is actually putting the focus not on the patient, but on the provider, because the research tells us that healthcare professionals are no more likely than the general population to have done advanced care planning, and that if they have not thought about these issues from a personal perspective, if they've not gone through the process, then they're just not comfortable. Most of us are not comfortable with things we don't know. And I think it should be part of new employee orientation, so that when people come into the institution, they know this is something that's important to the institution. It's important in the delivery of quality care as well.
Marshall, the need for this conversation goes beyond what we would usually think. It also extends to young adults, Caring Conversations for young adults.
While we talk about the aging of healthcare providers, the fact is that healthcare, and especially bedside healthcare, still remains largely an opportunity, a practice of young people and particularly young women, many of them in the process of the age, certainly, but in the process of having children and starting families. It becomes a great opportunity to catch them at a moment when they're particularly aware of these needs, with a tool that's catered more to their interest and to their focus. And I think certainly for the community, but especially for working with people in the hospital, working with staff, I want to emphasize the young adult aspect of this and the opportunity for them to, again, set their needs out early on, to have the conversations as their marriages are new, as their families are new, and to have this become a part of their life together right at the very beginning.
You know, Marshall, I think this is a very helpful tool as well, and we were very pleased that a group of young leaders, young people 16 to 24, worked with the staff here to actually create that document. And we have found that it may be helpful with people at the further ends of life, down the continuum, where people are beginning to not have as much cognitive capacity or as much tolerance for something that is more rational and literate and so forth. So it's very helpful, I think.
Myra, 2010 is a year when we take note of a couple of anniversaries important to the healthcare decisions we're talking about.
Next month marks the 20th anniversary of the passage of the Patient Self-Determination Act. 2010 is also the 20th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Cruzan. So this is an important reminder, I think, an important time for us to remember the basic tenets of both the court's decision and the federal law that we refer to as the Patient Self-Determination Act basically both say that adults with decision-making capacity have the right to choose and refuse any medical or surgical intervention. They have a right to name surrogates, to make advance directives, and that surrogates can make decisions even when those decisions may hasten death. What I think is important to note as well for our listeners is that the Patient Self-Determination Act requires institutions that receive federal dollars for reimbursement for care to do those things, to ask people if they have a directive, to ask them if they don't, would they like to have information about a directive, and if the person replies yes, to help them make advance directives. They also require public education to be provided by those same institutions who benefit from Medicare and Medicaid dollars.
Myra Christopher is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics, and Marshall Scott is the chaplain and manager for spiritual wellness at St. Luke's South Hospital in Overland Park, Kansas. For more information on April 16th, National Healthcare Decisions Day, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.